Chapter 7. At Sea. The pinnace was lashed to a platform between the aft and main masts in front of the command bridge, directly across from one of the warship's two deckhouses.
A brass lantern cast a pale glow through the grimy deckhouse windows,
and Thomas could see the sailor on watch was asleep in his chair. That was a hanging offense in wartime, and would merit at least a good lashing and confinement in the brig in peacetime, if the fellow was caught. He kept to the rail as he passed the steam funnels. The amidship deckhouse sat to the left of the forward funnel, and he could see the sailor on watch was awake and scanning the horizon with a brass telescope. He ducked low and scrambled past the deckhouse to the foremast, where he crouched down and listened for footsteps or voices. But the only sounds in the still night air were the rumble of the steam engine, the creaking of rigging swaying in the soft breeze, and the splash of waves against the ship's hull as it cut across a north-south current. 10 feet beyond the mast were stairs leading down to the foredeck. He took them in two strides, taking care to avoid the coils of rope and metal winching gear that covered much of the deck. His objective lay just ahead of the drum-shaped capstan, a 3-foot, square, hatch cover over the entrance of the forward hold. He remembered from the tour of the ship a week ago that this hold was used to store spare parts for the engine, along with ropes, cables, and rigging to replace any that might be lost or damaged in foul weather. Odds were that the hold would remain closed for the duration of the voyage, and he could hide in safety. He knelt beside the hatch and was pleased to find how easily it raised on its well-oiled hinges. It was pitch black below, but he could not risk lighting a candle in the open where it might be seen from the deckhouse. He pulled a candle and the matches from his bag and slipped them in his pocket before slinging the bag over his shoulder and stepping carefully onto the first metal rung. He took 2 more steps, turned, and pulled the hatch back down over his head. As dark as the interior of the pinnace had been, this was an even deeper blackness. The air was damp and musty, and the sound of the bow slicing through the waves was so loud he could have been tied to a bowsprit with his face only inches from the water. He lit a candle, climbed down into the hold, and set his bag on the floor before wedging a second candle behind a crossbar so that it was held in place against the hull. The flickering light cast shadows around the hold, where 4 oil lanterns dangled on a twisted metal cable just above his head. He took one down, removed the chimney, and lit the wick. When he lit a second lantern, the hold was illuminated as brightly as a parlor in a Nob Hill mansion. He was about to extinguish one of the lanterns to conserve fuel when he saw a stack of 5-gallon cans secured against the bulkhead. That was enough oil to light the hold for months. To celebrate this tiny bit of good fortune, Thomas pulled the bottle of corn from his bag, took a deep drink, and fired up the other lanterns so he could explore his new home. Stacked among the wooden crates of machine parts and rigging lines were 2 rolled-up mattresses, a pile of wool blankets, a box of books, and a collection of cast-iron cooking pots with lids. He wouldn't be doing any cooking, but the large Dutch ovens would do fine as chamber pots. He took another drink of the corn and wondered what his mother would think of that sacrilege. She was famous for the stews, roasts, bread, and cakes she produced in her Dutch ovens. But what he was going to fill them with would not be suitable for anyone's table. Ah, he thought as the liquor began to warm his insides. But she would be the first to forgive me. He slept until midday, and then pried open the box of books and rummaged through for any that might be in English or French. He was pleased to find an English version of the British naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace's 2-volume work, The Malay Archipelago, The Land of the Orangutan and the Bird of Paradise, wrapped tightly in an oilcloth wrapper. It had been on his reading list since its publication 3 years earlier, but he had never found the time to sit down with it. He tore a loaf of bread in half and set it on a box beside a lamp. Then he made himself comfortable on a folded blanket and opened Wallace's book. Time, it seemed, was no longer an issue. He fell into a routine over the next 3 days as the König Wilhelm steamed towards its next destination. He woke when the ship's bell signaled the 4 a.m. watch and waited a half hour before climbing out of the hold. Then he made his way up to the main deck and hid until the bakers appeared with their racks of fresh warm bread. On the second morning, they also set out trays of sweet rolls to cool in the damp pre-dawn air, which brought some much-needed variety to his diet. With his food secured, he returned to the hold, ate breakfast, and slept into the late afternoon. Then, to the sound of the deep Pacific flowing past his windowless stateroom, he settled in with Wallace's book, delving deep into the naturalist's remarkable account of his years studying the natural history, geography, and peoples scattered across the Malay Archipelago. On his fourth morning at sea, the bakers did not appear on deck at the usual time. He waited for 10 minutes, then turned to steal back to the forward hold before the crew's workday began. He had only taken a few steps when 4 shapes emerged out of the darkness. Rough hands grabbed his arms from behind, and a sailor, wearing a cap with a leather visor, held a lantern up to his face. He struggled to free himself, but his captors held him in an iron grip that only got stronger the more he fought. Then a massive fist smashed into his back, driving him down to his knees.
"Sprich, wer bist du?"
demanded the man holding the lantern.
"Was tun Sie hier?"
Thomas tried to catch his breath, but before he could say anything, a boot slammed into his back, and he was pushed flat onto the deck.
"Sprich," repeated the man. "Jetzt!"
Thomas pulled himself to his knees. All he could see in the darkness was a forest of legs.
"I'm an American," he finally said. "I don't speak German."
"Amerikanisch? Was zur Hölle?"
a voice said. Another man stepped forward and slapped Thomas hard across the face with the back of his hand. He wiped blood from the corner of his mouth and said, "Thanks for that, you bastard, but I still don't speak your gutter tongue."
"Ah, but now you have had your first lesson," said the man holding the lantern in heavily accented English. "As for Kurd, who you have just insulted, I will forgive you this time, for he actually is a bastard, born the illegitimate son of some minor nobleman in Prussia. Even so, I suggest you do not disparage his lineage again. Being the son of the town whore left him with a wicked temper."
The man chuckled at his own joke and then said,
"Helmut, Karl, steh ihn auf."
2 men broke through the knot of sailors surrounding Thomas and helped him to stand. Then the man with the lantern nodded to another sailor, who approached with a rope. The sailors, holding his arms, pulled him back and lashed him to the side of a wooden crate. The man giving orders said,
"You are stove on an imperial warship in international waters. And you are a thief. Did you think we would not notice our bread and sweet rolls disappearing these past few mornings? Der Kapitän will have many questions for you, my friend. In your favor, he is a man who enjoys a good yarn. I hope your story will amuse him. In the German Navy, it is customary to sow stowaways to the sharks."
Then he started to walk away.
"One question, please," said Thomas.
His captor turned and raised his eyebrows.
"Where are we going?"
The man shook his head and left without answering, but even in the darkness, Thomas could tell he was smiling. The sun broke the horizon astern of the ship a few minutes later. They were headed west, Thomas thought. The sunlight felt good after spending 5 days in darkness, even in his present circumstance. König Wilhelm came to life around him as sailors appeared from below to scrub decks, work the lines and gear, and prepare to unfurl the sails to supplement the single-propeller steam engine. The sailors were young, many of them in their teens, but when they passed Thomas tied to the crate, they paid him no more attention than they would to a monkey in a zoo. Rules of conduct aboard a ship of war were rigid and unbending, and corporal punishment for even the smallest infraction was swift and harsh. Even for an American war hero, his time would come. He was certain of that. Three piercing whistles interrupted his reflection, and sailors answered the call by swarming around the masts. He had never seen sails raised on a three-mast giant like the Wilhelm. At an officer's command, dozens of sailors leapt into action at each mast, and for the next 20 minutes, Thomas watched the organized chaos of lines being turned and hoisted. Men mounted the rigging and scrambled from station to station, and the great sails unfurling to catch the wind.
"Impressive, isn't it?"
Thomas turned his head. It was the man who had been holding the lantern. He wore the light wool coat and cap of an officer, and his face was decorated with a heavy mustache. Thomas nodded his head.
"I am First Officer Hans Stock. Captain Schmidt sends his compliments, Colonel. He sent his aide out this morning to look you over, and he recognized you as part of the delegation that visited his ship last week."
"Yes, I was here," replied Thomas, "although it was a much warmer welcome than this one." Stock smiled.
"You weren't committing a crime last time, Colonel."
Thomas could only shake his head. The First Officer was right. In fact, at this point, his situation had all the markings of an international incident. He could imagine the headlines his editor at the Chronicle would write. "Hero of Pebble Creek Ridge tried as stowaway on German warship. Colonel T.E. Scoundrel flogged and imprisoned. Ambassador demands immediate release."
"We are on a long voyage, and we have many days of steaming ahead,"
Stoch went on.
"We do have a brig, of course, and you could be confined there for the duration, but the captain has a different proposal, if you are willing."
"I'm listening."
"If you will give us your word as a military officer that you will follow our instructions and not attempt any more mischief, we will untie you. You will be treated decently, and you will be free to move around the ship. Do you agree?"
"Yes."
"This sailor will take you below to clean up and get some clothing," said Stock. "And he will get you some food. After 4 days of eating only bread, you are probably ready for something different."
"I am, thank you."
"After you eat, you will be taken to a duty officer who will assign you a berth and line out your duties. I hope you appreciate that you must earn your keep. This is a ship of war, after all, not a pleasure cruise."
Having something to do to occupy his mind sounded just right to Thomas.
"Of course," he answered. "The captain requests that you join him and the officers for dinner this evening. He may choose to share a destination with you at that time."
"I know that we are headed west by southwest," replied Thomas, "so I have a general idea." His remark was half truth and half bravado, but it was time for him to behave like a senior army officer, not a prisoner. To his surprise, Stock seemed pleased, both by his observation and his confident attitude.
"Perhaps you should have considered a career in the American Navy," he said.
Then he left Thomas in the sailor's custody and returned to his duties. An hour later, Thomas had bathed, changed into clean clothes, and gobbled down 2 bowls of excellent beef stew. His escort led him to a canvas-covered area on the main deck that served as the duty officer's open-air office.
"Can you work rigging lines?"
the officer asked from behind a cluttered table. Thomas shook his head.
"Do you know anything about steam engines?"
Again, Thomas shook his head. The officer continued down a list of possible duties, from assisting with the ship's carpenter to helping clean and maintain the ship's guns. Thomas was almost embarrassed at his own lack of practical skills. When the officer had exhausted his list of higher-order duties, he lit a cigar, took several puffs, and then asked,
"Can you perhaps paint?"
Thomas replied with a sheepish grin. He could paint. The officer barked a command, and 2 sailors appeared with a bucket of wire brushes and iron scrapers.
"First, you scrape, Colonel. Then, you paint," not exactly the kind of command duty you are used to, but it's honest work."
He shared a bemused smile with the sailors before he stood and turned to leave.
"Viel Glück, Herr Oberst," he chuckled as he walked away.
Thomas sighed and pulled a wire brush from the bucket. Then he followed the sailors to a rusting metal storage shed located near the stern.
"Viel Glück,"
he thought to himself as he began to scrape away the flaking paint. He was pretty sure it meant good luck.